from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Amandine Lee.
This week on War News Radio, after activism, we hear an update on the Arab Spring in Egypt.
Then, we hear about the role of women activists in the Libyan Revolution and Reconstruction.
Finally, we learn about the recent outbreak of dengue fever in Pakistan. This is War News Radio. From the start of the Egyptian Revolution in January to the ousting of President Hosni Mubarak in February, media attention was focused on Egypt and the rest of the Arab Spring. Nearly a year later, Egypt is reeling from recent events, such as delays in the ongoing trial of Hosni Mubarak. War News Radio's Anushka Mehta talks with Egyptians and others about the current climate in Egypt.
Nearly a year after the start of the Egyptian Revolution, Egypt is in a state of uncertainty. According to Al Jazeera, the events that took place on October 9th, with the army clashing with Coptic Christian protesters, raised questions about the sectarian tension between Muslims and Christians in Egypt.
It was a dream coming true for a man like me, acting for more than 35 years, trying to ignite it. It was a dream coming true. When it happened, it was a complete surprise for us, a very happy one, of course.
That was Mazen Mustafa, an engineer and businessman based in Cairo, and a member of various political parties over the past 30 years, explaining the suddenness of the revolution. Noha Atif Oberoi, a hotel manager living in Cairo, Egypt, who has been avidly watching the situation in Egypt as it's been unfolding, explains how the surprising factor of the revolution led to the current uncertainty.
Anybody will tell you that we know what will happen tomorrow, he's lying.
According to a recent NPR report, Coptic Christians represent 10% of the Egyptian population and are a powerful minority. Sectarian violence can lead to even more instability for Egypt. Evan Hill, an online producer for Al Jazeera English based in Doha, Qatar, explains the events that took place on October 9th.
The army felt overwhelmed and responded with an excessive level of force, and that it was simply a mistake that they made.
At least 17 protesters died during a majority Coptic Christian march. Hill explains that the army reacted to this march with force, opening fire on the protesters and running over people with army vehicles. He says that while many people believe that the regime and army may be using Christian-Muslim violence to their advantage, he hasn't seen evidence for that. Hill says that doesn't account for the fact that at the end of the day, the protesters were mainly Christian.
You saw the army use really serious violence against the Egyptian people came at a Christian demonstration. It may have been that commanders at some level, maybe those on the scene, felt that they could get away with it because this was a Christian protest that they thought did not have a high level of support in the community.
Mark Imad, a pharmacist based in Cairo, Egypt, says there was racial tension before the revolution even started.
But it was not on the surface because it spread out. Because as I told you, the police was controlling everything. Also the restrictions that was on the press and the restrictions on the people to speak. This all led to one thing, that nothing appeared on the surface before the revolution.
Mustafa agrees with Imad about the superficiality of the good relations between Coptic Christians and Muslims in Egypt.
I've always thought of media coverage with Muslim sheikhs and Copts priests holding hands and kissing each other's beard. And I always thought that this was actually a facade covering much deeper tension.
Mustafa adds that over the past 30 years, Christian-Muslim relations have been unstable and that the revolution brought certain tensions to light.
All these tensions that have been suppressed came up, and during the struggle on power that's happening after the revolution, these tensions are coming out more ugly.
Hill says the current uncertainty and violence stems from the initial shock of the revolution.
If I was being honest, I would say that the actual revolution came as somewhat of a surprise.
Hill agrees that the change in rapport between the Muslims and the Christians before, during, and after the revolution can be attributed to the fact that this tension has always been a major and overlooked issue.
A lot of it has to do with the way that Egyptians and the Egyptian authorities deal with sectarian violence, because their inclination is to sweep it under the rug.
Hill adds that non-activist Egyptians don't think sectarian violence is a big issue because of the positions that some Coptic Christians have been able to gain.
There are plenty of Copts who are successful businessmen, some of whom have made it to relatively high positions in government, although very rarely the highest positions in government or the judiciary.
Hill says that activists or researchers who have studied the issue have shown that in recent years, riots and anti-Christian mobs have become common outside of Cairo. He also explains that according to the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, which is an independent Egyptian human rights organization established in 2002, they often start with rumors about interreligious dating, the contentious issue of church building, or men of one faith preying on women of the other.
Before the revolution, it was a very big problem. And then you obviously had the Alexandria church bombing that happened this year, not too long before the revolution began.
Hill doesn't believe that there has been any conclusive evidence to suggest that the old regime was helping orchestrate these tensions between the two groups of people. However, Oberoi blames the government for failing to treat the issues.
Christian always have a problem here. You know, when you have a problem between two people and they're living, you know, like two brothers living in the same house, you have to sit and discuss with them and see whose fault it is. But unfortunately, the government never did like this.
Oberoi explains how well the Muslims and Christians got along during the revolution.
If you go to Tahrir Square during the revolution, you will never know who's Muhammad and who's George. Everybody was together.
She says that after the revolution, it's hard to say what changed to increase the tension between these two religious groups so dramatically. However, Mustafa explains the power vacuum that emerged after the revolution.
And there was that tension growing, and in the absence of the real patriotic power and the rise of the religious power on both sides.
However, Mustafa is optimistic about Egypt's future for similar reasons to Hill.
The kind of otherworldly feeling you got from standing in the middle of Cairo, in the middle, the sort of political, philosophical heart of Egypt, and seeing people from all over in this environment, you couldn't help but be filled with a sense of optimism.
Hill says this optimism may be unrealistic and wonders about whether Egyptians will be able to take on another authority and force a faster transition. Imad sees a clear priority for the country.
I think that we need education before democracy.
Oberoi is optimistic about Muslim-Christian relations, at least after the authorities restore control.
By nature, Egyptians are we're not aggressive people. By nature, we have something called me and my brother against my cousin, and me and my cousin against the people outside. So this would mean that if we feel that Egypt will be threatened, I think everybody will be together again. But this will not happen except when the law, you know, like they enforce the law.
There are many opinions being voiced in Egypt right now, and not much can be said for certain due to how short a time lapse there has been since the revolution. The lower parliamentary elections took place on the 28th of November, and according to Al Jazeera, the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party took 36.6% of the vote. However, the future of the country is still uncertain, as there are many steps still to take place before a new government gains control. For War News Radio, I'm Anushka Mehta.
This is War News Radio. Libyan women, both expatriates working remotely and nationals involved at home, have been among the earliest supporters of the movement to overthrow Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi since protests began in February 2011. War News Radio's Amy DiPiero speaks with some of the female activists about how they shaped the war and how they hope to shape the peace to come. When Shahrazad Kablan heard protests had broken out in Tunisia, she was jubilant.
Oh, I loved it. I jumped on it right away. I was a supporter the first day, actually.
Kablan, an English as a second language teacher currently living in Washington, D.C., spent part of her childhood in Libya during Muammar Gaddafi's regime. She dreamed that a spark from Tunisia would ignite unrest in her home country.
I was hoping and wishing that it will continue to Libya. And when it, you know, jumped and moved to Egypt, I was a little disappointed.
Kablan's disappointment didn't last long. By February 17th, anti-government protesters had taken to the streets of Libya, too. Today, Kablan is just one among many claiming the rights she was denied in Gaddafi's Libya. Since Gaddafi's death in October, female activists like Kablan have worked to give women a voice, as voters and as top-tier politicians, in a new government. Nonetheless, the women recognize the potential barriers to their mission.
When you bring up the subject of women's empowerment, it's often thought that you're talking about women being able to drink and smoke and, you know, go out.
That's Nadia Maddox, an independent Libyan-American activist based in Somerset, California. She says female empowerment is about guaranteeing women's rights in politics, work, and family.
It's making sure that women are protected under the law in Libya, that they have a basis for pursuing their dreams in life.
Maddox says even though some Libyans think female empowerment threatens traditional roles as wives and mothers, her own experience as a married working mother actually helps her to work with female activists in Libya. Like them, Maddox has to make time for work while taking care of her two-year-old daughter.
It's actually been very liberating to work with such understanding and compassionate women, you know.
Women in Libya may have another limitation they've turned into an advantage. Zahra Langi, a Cairo-based activist, says Gaddafi's arbitrary rule created de facto gender parity.
Basically, there were human rights violations for all, men and women.
But Kablan isn't so sure that discrimination affected men and women equally. She says many families pulled their daughters out of Gaddafi's military schools for fear of sexual and physical abuse. She thinks consequences were worse for the women recruited to work for Gaddafi.
Anyone who did anything with the government were looked at as loose women or not good women anymore.
Despite this stigma, the United Nations 2011 Human Development Report found that over 55% of adult Libyan women have received a secondary level of education or higher, in comparison to just 44% of Libyan men. At the same time, the UN reported that only a quarter of women are a part of Libya's workforce, a figure dwarfed by 80% of men. Whatever conditions women faced before the conflict, Kablan remembers widespread and sudden activism among her female relatives in Benghazi and Misrata as soon as protests began.
If it wasn't for women, this revolution would have been, you know, crushed the first day. They were the ones who are pushing the kids. I remember my sister will be saying to me, you know, all my kids are out. All my kids, I told them not to come home until Benghazi is liberated. And it's like, I was crying the day she told me this.
Back in Washington, D.C., Kablan participated in rallies outside the White House and tried to adapt her experience fundraising for her ESL program to fundraising for a revolution. Admittedly, she says the two causes weren't exactly the same.
I never had any experience working with NGOs or guns and war and all that.
In California, Maddox began by organizing charity dinners in the U.S., using the money she raised to send clothing, food, and medical supplies to Libyan refugees in Tunisia and wounded rebels in Misrata.
Langi also began her mission remotely. Working from Cairo during Egypt's revolution in January 2011, Langi started to organize other exiled Libyans beginning in early February.
We thought of creating here as Libyans in diaspora and specifically in Egypt, of creating and organizing a lobbying group that would support the Libyan revolution.
Since Gaddafi's death, the goal of the women's movement has shifted from the daily tasks of sustaining a revolution to the long-term process of building a civil society. For Langi, this means using media outreach and education to generate support for women's legal, political, and civil rights.
You can never have a better legal status and a better legal political participation if you don't build for that in the education system, in the curriculum, what I mean, and in the media.
But how can this platform be implemented? Langi says Western powers have historically had a double standard when it came to human rights abuses, targeting Iraq under Saddam Hussein, but tolerating Libya under Gaddafi. But since NATO troops helped to unseat Gaddafi, Langi anticipates an opportunity for deeper collaboration among Libyans and the Western world.
This could be seen as a start for a new era where one could build on good faith and eventually that we would have shared values.
At the same time, Kablan says the international community shouldn't demand immediate change from their Libyan partners.
The international community especially need to remember that we were under Gaddafi for 42 years. We never had anything to do with democracy, with election, with choosing, with knowing what's our right.
Frederick Wary of California-based think tank The Rand Corporation also acknowledges that Libya has a lot of work to do before it can guarantee democratic rights to women and to citizens in general. Most importantly, Libyans need to find a new way to unite after the death of Gaddafi.
There are divisions, obviously, within the rebel ranks, and those divisions could surface now that the common foe of Gaddafi is gone.
Despite the risk of splintering factions, Kablan is optimistic about Libya's future government.
I'm not afraid of who's going to take over. I think Libya has so many capable people and so many talented people who can run the country.
Langi says women must recognize themselves among these leaders.
I always say, I rather think of us women empowering our society rather than being in need of empowerment.
Women like Langi must make this transition from merely being empowered to empowering others within the next 8 months. Elections, tentatively set for this June, will be their ultimate referendum. For War News Radio, I'm Amy DePiro.
This is War News Radio. This year, the government in Pakistan is struggling to contain an outbreak of dengue fever, which has killed at least 300 people and sickened more than 20,000. War News Radio's Tian Vo takes a look at how conflict, climate, and changing infrastructure are affecting public health in Pakistan.
The latest outbreak of dengue fever in central Pakistan is the largest South Asia has seen in recent years. According to the World Health Organization, while the disease has been seen across the country, there's been an explosion of dengue in the Punjab capital of Lahore, over 16,500 cases and 250 deaths since the outbreak began in August. Dr. Anita Zaidi, head of pediatrics at the Aga Khan University Hospital in Karachi, says the rising cases of dengue has stoked a panic in the city.
In Lahore, pretty much everybody seems to have gotten dengue. It's daily been like wildfire. Friends and acquaintances and colleagues, everybody's gotten it.
Zaidi says conditions in Lahore have created optimal breeding grounds for the mosquitoes that spread the disease. In its scattered efforts, the government has struggled to coordinate the response in hospitals and educate the public on prevention.
With population growth and more urbanization, climate change, there's been floods, water is scarce, and you know that in urban environments when water becomes scarce, that's a very big risk factor for dengue because what people start doing is they start storing water in containers.
Although dengue fever is rarely fatal, it spreads quickly and easily. The Aedes aegypti mosquito breeds in household water pots, car tires, and the pools of water that have collected from floods and abundant rain. Even doctors and nurses are susceptible, as poor sanitation in hospitals has amplified the disease. At the height of the outbreak, nearly 100 new cases of dengue were reported in Punjab each day. Haider Warraiq, a contributor to Foreign Policy magazine and international research fellow at Harvard University, says measures taken at the outset of the epidemic were ineffective.
Some of the measures that they are taking include outdoor spraying of insecticide, which is a good measure in allaying people's fears, and it is a good political move because it is very, very visible, but that has not been shown to be a very effective way of actually dealing with the mosquitoes on an effective scale.
The government also set up outdoor treatment wards, distributed mosquito nets, and ran television ads. But Warraiq believes that all the media coverage only inflamed irrational fears about the outbreak.
There's also a lot of TV broadcast and newspaper coverage of the epidemic, but at times that does more to scare people and instill paranoia as opposed to get people to do the things that are necessary.
Zaidi says the media focuses on epidemics like dengue because almost everybody feels in danger, rather than reporting on diseases that kill more people.
For example, in Lahore, more children might be dying of pneumonia or diarrhea, but you're not going to hear about that because that's not the elite does not perceive itself to be at risk from these diseases.
As to why over 300 people have died from dengue, Dr. Faisal Sultan, CEO of Shaukat Khanum Hospital in Lahore, says given the sheer size of this outbreak, the number of deaths is not unusual. But doctors don't fully understand why the latter half of this epidemic has produced more severe and potentially fatal cases of dengue.
There was some thought that maybe the tail end of the epidemic seemed to show some more severe cases. In dengue, very often the disease is mild and self-limited. But if you have a second, if you're challenged with a different type the next year, you end up having more severe disease.
Although he believes the initial response was ineffective, Sultan says the shift to preventive measures has helped calm the public and prove dengue is manageable. The government recently worked with WHO experts from Thailand, where floodwaters and dengue are common, to sponsor educational workshops for doctors and teachers. In October, volunteers launched a Facebook page called Shahbaz Sharif's Anti-Dengue Community, named after the Punjab chief minister, to spread awareness of the disease.
Yeah, I think the latter half of the response was more evidence-based, more mature, more targeted, focused on reality and to actions and things that could make sense. So I would say that I was better satisfied with once they actually focused on the education of the public and to involve and recruit everybody towards the fight to reduce dengue and to prevent bites and to reduce reservoirs, etc.
But many are critical of some of the tactics used to coordinate the response. For example, the government forced hospitals to offer free beds for dengue patients and fixed the price on complete blood counts to about $1 per test. According to Zaidi, doctors could go to jail for failing to comply.
They were almost authoritarian. I mean, they could have negotiated rates and the government should have paid the subsidized price or made up the difference to the private providers and not forced them to subsidize public care.
Although the cheap tests were meant to make treatment more widely affordable, Sultan said it created a run on the tests and supplies of platelets.
A lot of people were trying to get themselves transfused with platelets, even when they did not have such low levels that merited a transfusion. So that created a run on unlimited resource and had the potential of creating a situation that a small proportion that truly would require transfusion of platelets were going to be denied.
The dengue crisis follows the dissolving of the National Ministry of Health in June, as part of a much larger amendment devolving many federal responsibilities to the provinces. Dr. Sania Nishtar, the founder and president of HeartFile, a nonprofit which helps developing countries improve their public health systems, says that while the move is widely supported by many political factions, the government did little to plan the transition.
But something as radical as this needed to be done with very careful planning and with a very careful rollout phase. Somehow that was not, and as a result, there are some problems.
While the devolution has not had a significant impact on the dengue response in Punjab, it has brought attention to weaknesses in provincial health structures, especially efforts against infectious disease. Although Punjab has the most robust health system, even they struggled to combat the outbreak. In the case of Pakistan's polio endemic, differences in provincial health care means many children are not getting vaccinated. According to the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, Pakistan accounts for one-third of polio cases across the globe, with 145 cases just this year.
If you look at FATA and NWP, most of the inability to access children because of the insurgency. If you look at Quetta and Balochistan, which has had a very big outbreak this year, that's related to local governance issues. People that are in charge in those districts are corrupt, and they accept the money for the campaigns. They don't give out that money, so people aren't actually doing the vaccine campaign.
Zaidi says for provinces lacking in a functioning healthcare sector, more immediate crises like floods have pushed polio to the bottom of their priorities.
There might have been 27 cases of polio in Sindh, but there were thousands of diarrheal deaths and pneumonia deaths and snake bites and things like that. So which is a bigger priority for the local area?
Wareik believes both polio and dengue illustrate how the federal government needs to play some role in public health. He's critical of the lack of collaboration on infectious disease prevention between Pakistan and India, where the public health situation is vulnerable to both diseases.
What is happening really is that people are being quarantined at the border if they are traveling from one of the countries to another, and trains that actually go from one side of the border to the other are being sprayed with insecticide. As far as actually getting public health people to talk to each other, etc. is concerned, there's no real platform that exists for something to happen.
But given the long-standing historical tensions between the two countries, he doesn't believe they will collaborate anytime soon.
Putting it into context, one outbreak is not going to reverse the lack of collaboration between these two countries. Currently, I don't think there's an initiative on either side to overcome this lack of collaboration.
As the cold season comes and the mosquitoes cease to breed, Punjab will have some respite from dengue. But that doesn't put an end to the disease and health challenges that Pakistan faces in the months and years ahead. For War News Radio, I'm Tian Vo.
I'm Sam Hirschman, one of the contributors to War News Radio. War News Radio will be suspending our show after next week. We are transforming and moving on to new media and topics, but will continue to produce high-quality content. Thank you very much for your support over the past 5 years, and we hope you will continue to engage with us.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Amy DiPiero, Max Nesterak, Jared Nolan, Colin Smith, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Amandine Lee. Until next time, thanks for listening.